That's, maybe I didn't word my question right, but that's sort of what I was aiming at in my question, the idea of it becoming a way of life, about what does the honor system mean to you today, to you personally?
Oh, no question about that. You deal with people fairly and honestly, and one of the sad parts, and of course it's a it's the system under which we live, and it bothers me a great deal. I've had a few brushes with attorneys in the legal arena. It doesn't make any difference whether it's right or wrong, or it's fair or it's unfair, or it's ethical or it's unethical. It's either legal or it's illegal, and that is the sole judge. And I think that the legal system of the United States is hurting because of that. I think you've got to give the judges some leeway and let them apply some justice rather than just some laws to what they do.
Do you remember how the honor system was introduced to you when you arrived here?
Yeah, we at that point in time we had what was then called freshman camp, and which is a very, very marvelous thing, or was. I don't know whether they still do it or not. We went out to a Boy Scout camp about 14, 15 miles from here up Goshen Passway, maybe it's a little farther than that. And we were there for about 5 days, as I recall, and you got to know your freshmen real well. Early on, before you ever got into class. And at that time, they had, of course, a number of seniors out there who acted as sort of counselors and would talk to us about the history of the university and what went on here, and among those, of course, was the honor system. And it was presented to us that when you have a paper to hand in, you fold the paper lengthwise, and you put up at the top, you put your signature, and you put the word pledge, and you signed it. And this meant, quote, "I pledge on my honor as a Washington Lee gentleman that I have neither given nor received any information in regard to this paper." And that was the way you conducted yourself, and that was the way it was presented to us in freshman camp. If we didn't want this to comport ourselves in that fashion, then we probably shouldn't be there. So it put everybody on the same basis early, before you ever got to class.
You mentioned the idea of a Washington and Lee gentleman. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you?
To me, it means that you conduct yourself at all times as a gentleman, and that you respect other people and their rights, and you have a responsibility to do that.
And this permeated all aspects of life here?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, it sure seems to have.
I don't recall being mistreated by anybody at any time under any circumstances.
And getting back to where we started, even in the pranks, even in the tricks.
I don't think there was anything nasty about that. I mean, it was fun what was done, and it managed to all work out in the end. I don't think anybody got hurt.
Well, it seems like there was just a great sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah.
The fraternity, that whole concept of fraternities, do you think that it's stronger here than at other places?
I think it was at that time. Whether it is now or not, I really don't know. At that particular time, about 75 or 80% of the student body was in a fraternity. And in general, if if you really wanted to be in a fraternity, you could be in a fraternity.
How'd you pick your fraternity?
I really picked it by one man. He happened to be a senior at freshman camp. And I got to know him rather well there. And he seemed to be the type of individual that I admired. He was a veteran. And when Rush Week came, and of course, under the rules of that we had operating in those days, you have Rush Week, and you go out to all these fraternities for lunch or dinner or cocktails or whatever, and you are supposedly rushed. I met his fraternity brothers and became impressed with them and decided that that's where I would like to be. And so I put them down as my first choice. Mm-hmm. As I recall, I don't even think I put down any other choices. I don't think I had a second or third. And it happened that my roommate, who was from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, whom I had never met before, also put down the same fraternity. And whether he had any second or third choices, I have no idea. But we both ended up there.
And where was your house located?
It was at 301 East Washington Street.
Mm-hmm.
Phi Kappa Psi House.
And that's over by what's now City Hall?
I don't know if that's City Hall or not.
It was a school back then, I think?
Yeah, it was a school at that time. Is that City Hall?
Uh-huh,
yeah,
that's City Hall now.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What was the house like? Take me in the house. Describe the house to me.
Oh, you walk up, starting at the street, you walk up four or five steps and walk along a winding concrete path, and up about 10 steps, the house set up on a hill. It was a white frame building at that time. It's brick now. And you walked in through these huge double doors into a front hall. On the left side was a small library, perhaps 12 by 15, that sort of thing. On the right-hand side was quite a large living room, about 35 by 15. In the back, on the left, was a dining room which would seat about 75, well, probably maybe 85 or 90 in the dining room. And the kitchen was behind the living room. We had a rule there in the fraternity house, which was, as far as I was concerned, delightful, since I was not one of the wealthy boys who went to school here. And the rule was that if you had a date on the weekend, you were expected to bring her out to the house for your meals. And there was no charge for that. Our dues, monthly dues, took care of that. And so that was a marvelous thing. It also tended on weekends to fill up the dining room with some nice young ladies. So it was, the rule had two reasons for being a rule. It was helpful and it was also nice.
85 or 90 people, that must have been a huge dining room.
Well, it was pretty big. We had tables for eight, and I suspect that we had about 10 tables in there. It was pretty big.
And the kitchen could accommodate that many
mm-hmm.
people?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then there were houses like this all over town?
I can't speak for houses like this, but there were large fraternity houses all around town. I think we had 17 fraternities or something like that at that time.
Now, was this the period where things were still pretty formal? Did you have formal dinners?
Oh, no. Uh-uh. The only time you had any formal attire was on formal dance weekends. I mean, there was openings in fancy dress in spring and then finals. And that's the only time that you ever got dressed up into formal attire.
And
of course, you had coats and ties. You wore coats and ties to class every day. If you earned a letter in any sport, you were permitted to wear a letter sweater instead of a sport coat or a suit coat or that sort of thing. But you wore a tie and a coat or a letter sweater to every class. And as a result, one of my aphorisms that my kids have heard so much, if you're dressed like a gentleman, you're more likely to act like one.
And do your kids go along with that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned all these formal events. Were you a big one for going to formal events?
Sometimes. It depended on my financial standing at that particular point in time. If I had the money, I would go. If I didn't, I wouldn't. You know, just all depends.
Did you go to fancy dress?
I went to fancy dress on, I think, 3 of my 4 years here. 1 year I did not go.
Any particular big events? Anything you remember?
No, not particularly.
Were you involved in planning it, or?
No, I was not involved in planning it.
How about mock convention? Did you get involved with that?
No, I didn't get involved in planning that either. I was involved in it because everybody participated, but I didn't get involved in that. A lot of the time I spent when I was here was working. I had several jobs.
What kind of jobs did you have?
Well, I drove a laundry truck and had a room in the basement of the freshman dorm where I had laundry and dry cleaning that the boys would bring in, and I would take down to the Rockbridge Laundry at that time, which I don't think is any longer there, and they would do the shirts and the suits and the sport coats and so on, and I would bring them back. And then I enlarged that and went out to some of the fraternity houses around town and took care of their needs for that. And then I ran the scoreboard at the home football games for a couple of years. And
really?
Then I used to sell corsages. I had a florist up in Stanton that would make corsages, and I would distribute those around to the fraternity houses. And then they also, for a couple of years there, I was in charge of the coat check at some of the dances. And so the funny part of it was that it got along pretty well there, that it came to the point when I got out of school and went to work in a full-time job, I had to take a cut in pay.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I was making more money at Washington and Lee while I was going to school than the job that I got when I graduated from Washington and Lee.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was. I had a fellow working for me who, when we branched out the laundry and dry cleaning business, so I hired one of my fraternity brothers, and he worked for me. And,
so was this something you started up, or?
No, it was already here. I went to the dean and told him, when I was a freshman, I told him that I needed some additional income and that I understood that positions of some sort might be available to students. So he got me in with the young man who was running the laundry and dry cleaning at that point in time, and I became his assistant. And when he graduated, I thought I was going to get the job, but it didn't occur. Another fellow got that job, but he was a senior at that time, and I was just a sophomore. So when he graduated, then I did get that job, and it was a very... it wasn't terribly time consuming. We only kept the laundry and dry cleaning office open certain hours a day. It did not stay open all day long. And it was, I also earned a little extra money at that time. The laundry was here in Lexington, but they had a number of employees who were from Buena Vista. And I don't know how the laundry got into this, but somehow or other they got into supplying transportation for these people who worked in Buena Vista. And the laundry manager asked me one day, would I want to earn a little extra money? And I said, sure. And he said, well, he said, if you'll come in at 6 o'clock in the morning, we'll have one of our large trucks fitted with benches, and you drive to Buena Vista and pick up the people that work here in Buena Vista, and they will sit on those benches in the back of the truck, and you drive them back here, and as long as you get them here before 10 minutes to 7, that'll be fine, and we'll pay you so much money for doing that, and you do that 5 days a week. So I thought that was pretty good, so I did that too. And it was a good experience.
So were you a C school major?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you were putting your education to work right away.
I was trying pretty hard to do that, yeah. That was, it was kind of funny. I was in the college, I was in the academic school, and I decided that I wanted to switch to it and get a BS in commerce. I don't know exactly why I decided that, but I, because at that age, I don't think you really know what you want to do, but I decided that I wanted to do that. Well, I was pretty far along in the academic end of things, and I had a couple of semesters there. I had to take 6 courses instead of 5 in order to catch up on some of the prerequisites that had been left behind. And I remember one of my fellow fraternity brothers kidding me and saying, boy, you're so dumb, you went over there and transferred in the School of Commerce. And he said, you're going to have to write a dissertation, and you don't have to do that over in the AB school, you know. And I said, well, I'm sure I'll think of something to write about, maybe the laundry business or something by the time it happens, you know. Well, by the time I became a senior, the dissertation for your degree became optional and was no longer mandatory, which caused him to scream, because he said, if I had known they were going to do that, I would have switched over to commerce school too. And I said, well, I had no inner knowledge. It just happened that way.
So you did not write?
I didn't have any knowledge about it.
No, you didn't write a dissertation?
Oh, I did not write a dissertation. No, I did not. I did not. I debated about it for a while, but I decided that I would not. I didn't see that there was any big advantage to me in doing that.
How about teachers outside the Commerce School? Were there anybody who was real important?
There was Fitzgerald Flournoy, who was an English professor, who was excellent in...
Why?
Oh, he was just, he knew his English literature, and he was just a great teacher. And then there was a Dr. Barrett in Spanish. I was rather impressed that he was a self-admitted persona non grata with the Franco government in Spain. He had been over there during the revolution. And he was an excellent teacher, very fluent in Spanish. And then we had a Dr. Welch, who was a fine mathematics professor. And these three gentlemen I took while they were sophomore courses, but I took them while I was a freshman. So that may be why I was impressed with them. They were a step above. And of course, Bill Jenks in history was excellent, but probably the rest of my time was that I was really happiest was over in Commerce School. And, I thoroughly enjoyed the courses. We had a Professor M. Ogden Phillips who was he taught industrial geography of the United States, of the North America and South America, foreign trade theory and practice, and was very, very memorable lecturer. I remember him very clearly. But L.K. Johnson stood out among everyone else. I I particularly enjoyed LK from the standpoint that we would, on weekends we were encouraged to bring our dates to class. And I always, whenever I had a date, I always brought her to class, and of course we had class on Saturdays. And LK had the habit of coming into the room and not looking at the students. He would come into the room, he would turn around, he would start to close the door and begin speaking. And he would begin speaking in the other direction. And he would go up to the desk, speaking as he did, and he would turn around and he would look around the class. And if he happened to see any one or more young ladies in the class, he would keep on talking for another sentence or two, and then he would say, gentlemen, skip about 8 or 10 pages in your notes and be with the fact that we have some guests here this morning. He said, I think this might be a more interesting subject to them. And he said, what we will discuss now is, and he would pick some subject that it was integral to his course, but he would pick an area that would interest the young ladies who were present, such as display windows in retail stores and this sort of thing. And Monday, he would come back into class and he would close the door and be facing the opposite direction and begin talking. And he would continue right where he was on Saturday. And he would finish that subject and it would take him a sentence or two. And then he would say, now if you'll turn back 12 or 15 pages in your notes, as I told you before, we will go on where we started before we had our visitors in the classroom. And he would go right back exactly where he was before. And it was just a marvelous thing to listen to a man that had that capability.
Mm. Wow. That's a great performer, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How about Jim Layburn? He was dean when you were here.
He was dean when I was here. Most impressive man. I did not know him well when he was here. I did not have any particular reason to spend time in the dean's office for whatever, one way or the other. I got to know him better, I would say. I got to know him rather well 10 or 12 years ago. When I came up for various functions and alumni college experiences, and he spoke to us on the Scots, who the whole area around Rockbridge County was originally settled by Scots and some Scots-Irish people. And he wrote a book on that subject and was an outstanding authority. I think he did wonderful things for the university. Raised our sights and was an example for the future. He's a great man. We had a lot of great men here. We're very fortunate in that respect.
Yeah, it sure seems like it.
Did you ever have you ever talked to Charlie McDowell?
Yes.
Did Charlie tell you of his great disillusionment?
Tell me.
No, I'd rather you get it from Charlie.
Well, tell me so I know what to ask him. Well, I'm going to be seeing him again.
Are you? Okay. Well, Charlie was a bad boy. This is not while I was here in Washington. This is a story Charlie tells himself. He was a bad boy for the Washington and Lee generals. And at the age of perhaps 7 or 8 years old, maybe 9, and of course he was seated over on the Washington and Lee side. And during this particular game, Washington Lee was at bat, and there was a man on first base. And somebody said to Charlie, go get us some Cokes, kid. And he said, okay, and he started around the backstop because he had to go around the backstop in order to get to where the Cokes were, and the Cokes being quite a ways beyond the third baseline. And as he was walking around there was a crack of the bat, and he looked, and the Washington Lee runner on first took off, and the batter had hit a line drive out to right center field, and the runner ran around third base, and Charlie kept walking along and watching, and the right fielder threw the ball in, and it came in, and it got past the third baseman of the opposing team and landed at Charlie's feet. And Charlie picked up the ball and threw it to the third baseman. And the third baseman threw it to home plate. The Washington Lee man had gotten up from his slide and gone for home. And he slid in to home plate, and the umpire ruled safe. And the opposing manager, coach, came out of his bench, and he had this rule book in his hand, and he objected to the umpire. And quite a hullabaloo arose over this, and Charlie was standing there and looking at the umpire and looking at this manager, and they called over Captain Dick Smith, who was our coach and manager at the time, also our athletic director. And Captain Dick was known as sometimes a very guttural, straight-faced fellow, very nice man, but he could be a little strong. And the other coach, waving this book, said, it says right here in the book, I quote, "Shall a member of the opposing team's bench touch the ball while it is in play, the runners shall be sent back to their previously attained bases." So he said, your two players have to go back. The man that scored has to go back to third. The man that is on second has to go back to first. And the umpire looked at that, and he turned to Captain Dick, and he said, "Is this a member of this young man a member of your bench?" And Captain Dick looked at him and said, "I never saw the little bastard before in my life." Now you get that from Charlie.
I will.
Because that's his story, not mine.
Yeah, but you told it pretty well.
No, but that's his story. It's not my story. No.
Frank Parsons has told me this story too. Yeah. I didn't get it from Charlie. Charlie told me some good stories though.
You get it from Charlie. You get it from, did Charlie tell you?
Hold on, let me pop in another tape. Mm-hmm.